When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Today, Phil Habercurn of Boston University is back to discuss an important Brand chapter. This one was fun because early on, Phil's kind of ho-hum about Brand, and then by the end of the chapter, I have him fully converted. After that, my friend Podrick McCarron joins me. Just a quick shout out to the boys at Bald Move, who are doing fine work covering Ahsoka and The Walking Dead, Daryl Dixon. Be sure that you check out everything that's going on at baldmove.com. Without further ado, here is Dr. Phil Habercurn. Let me ask you this about Bran. Do you find Bran an interesting character?
No. That's not fair. It's not so much Bran as I will admit when we first talked about doing this chapter, I find the Winterfell specific storyline in this book to be kind of my least favorite part, because so much else is happening in a sort of politically rich conflict among the Baratheon brothers and the Lannisters and Robb Stark, and that is like building in this moment. And you know, we have Jon Snow north of the wall, and we're sort of, that's kind of approaching a first crest, and every time we divert to Winterfell, I'm like, okay, like,
is this the issue of the reader being smarter than the character in the story? Because I feel like for astute readers, we know Bran's a warg. Like, even if this is our first read, it's like, yeah, we saw the clues. We saw them chapter one. You know, we and now we're like mid-book, and we've been reading the clues all along, and we know that Bran is warging into summer. But, of course, Bran doesn't know this yet. And so it's sort of a slow burn of his, you know, the waking of his third eye, as Jojo calls it, right? And I think there's some of it that feels like maybe it's too slow a burn. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it could be sped up a little bit, or maybe it's even just all of the sort of political and military kind of background to this chapter, where we have, you know, Boltons and Lady Hornwood and, you know, the threat of the Iron Islanders. Right. And so even as we want Bran to go on this journey of self-discovery to become, you know, this green seer along with a warg, it almost feels like all of the extra stuff around it is distracting us from that central heroic journey. So maybe it's almost, if we streamlined the focus to Bran, I would be more satisfied, and maybe practically it would speed it up. But it's, for me, it's a lot of the extras around the edges of the early Bran story, you know, where I want him in intense, you know, training sessions with Jojen, trying to figure out how to open this eye, or, you know, long talks with Asha.
Speed it up.
Or is it for, do you say Osha or Asha?
I've always said Asha. I could do it. I could be doing it wrong.
But I want, you know, she's parceling out information that's really useful and helpful and meaningful, but they're never just sitting down and having a long talk. So I guess I'm with you. Because I interpreted your sense that this could be sped up a little bit. I would like to get to Bran as fully or somewhat fully developed worgen greenseer, as opposed to the sort of stumbling forward.
Yeah, and I think that the trick is, if he does speed it up, maybe he doesn't seem authentically 10 years old, or was he, how old is he supposed to be? I should
he's
know
nine
this.
Or 10. Yeah. That's a good point.
So, I think he is like nine or something like that. Yeah. So I think maybe this is a reread issue. I think most of the chapters are really rewarding on reread. Like, I'm just reading through, the cat chapter where the shadow creature kills Renly. Yes. And there are so many details that I didn't remember. And it's just so interesting. And this book right now is ramping up, like you say.
Yes.
I don't know. Not every element of the book can be rewarding on reread. Say that they're not important elements, because they tie the story together.
But at the same time, like going back to this chapter, rereading it and then seeing the way it's treated in the show, where it's wildly different than it is in the book, even down to who has the dream of Winterfell going underwater, which is kind of remarkable. I found a lot in this chapter, which is sort of the, despite my saying earlier that I don't love the Bran story, I found a lot in this chapter that was just super, super interesting. And this goes back to all of these different kinds of religious systems that are sort of coexisting in the world of Westeros and Essos. But at the same time, there is this bedrock conviction here that is borne out in prophecy. And the idea that certain people can see the future and that the future is immutable, that is totally fascinating to me as a sort of foundational kind of metaphysical concept in this world.
Yeah, even though Bran is a little bit frustrating as in terms of his character development, this chapter does some really interesting things with determinism and fate. And not only like even if you do go in for Jojen's view of what green dreams are, we kind of know in retrospect that, or at least I think I know in retrospect, that it still takes the prophet to interpret these things, and the prophet is valuable, right? So
yes, and that is just like that idea of like the metaphorical dream that will come true, but you won't understand how it's coming true until after the fact.
Yeah.
It's just so deeply embedded, not just in the sort of Western literary mythological sort of tradition, but globally, that I guess it's the most interesting question that comes up, that came to me out of this chapter, is, what offers that certainty, right? It's not providence in a Christian sort of all omniscient deity sort of sense. It might be fate, which I think is the word you used. It could be something like destiny. It could be some one of these divine pantheons that inspires the person to see into the future. We don't know exactly what underpins that, but it's almost like a bedrock. Hmm. It's a bedrock belief here that we see borne out, at least in the case of the green dreams.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And it helps to have a character like Jojen who just is—he's so certain. Like his faith is just unshakable.
Yes.
And to have him as a foil against Mira. Who I think may be the older and wiser of the two, but I think is sort of I'm not sure how to read her voice in these things.
Well, it feels like she's protecting her brother.
She doesn't. I don't know if she just doesn't like the prophecies that will result in eventual pain, or whether or not it's sort of like no. Philosophically, none of this makes sense unless you can have some kind of control over your own fate.
Right.
So I'm not sure how to read what she's doing in this chapter.
It's interesting because I totally think you are dead on that. She seems to really, the idea that there's no agency, there's no choice, there's no ability to change the outcome is clearly frustrating to her. But there's also a very pragmatic element of, hey, if you go and tell people that they're going to die,
they just won't believe
don't
you.
Expect to thank you. Don't expect to thank you. Which makes me believe, you know, that her brother must have walked that path before, you know, and shared his dreams in this with the expectation that he would be helping people.
Or maybe she just knows instead, the way the world works. It's like,
well, there is that too.
You know, people, if you tell people that the ocean's going to collapse on Winterfell, they're not going to believe it because that's not the way the world works. She's fascinating to me. Let me read my synopsis here. We'd talk more about this.
Absolutely.
Well, assisting Mickon, the blacksmith, Bran is alerted that King Robb has sent a letter. The unfortunately named Alebelly carries Bran to Maester Luwin. Together with Rickon and the Frey boys, Bran learns of the Battle of Oxcross and that Severon Frey is dead. Later on, Jojen discusses dreams with Bran, who is now a believer in green dreams. Jojen tells Bran two of his dreams. First, the ocean will come to Winterfell. Second, a man named Reek will kill and flay both Bran and Rickon. So, I mean, my feeling is that the dreams are like the most interesting thing about this chapter. We're already talking about, why don't we just keep talking about that for a bit?
Okay. Although I will say I couldn't recall when I was rereading this and sort of doing a little prep work for our conversation. Is this the first time we get clarity on warging and this idea of sharing consciousness with an animal in like a clear and explicit way?
So it's interesting. I think in the last Bran chapter, Jojen kind of explains what a warg is to Bran. Mm-hmm. Bran in turn goes to Lewin, and Lewin explains to him that there are stories, and let me tell you about these stories. Different kinds of people used to be able to take control of the bodies of animals and birds and fish and things like that. So I think that there has been some kind of exposition on this, but the specific naming of Bran, hey, you are a warg, this is the chapter where that happens.
Okay. Because that's another sort of, again, there are so many folkloric and mythological variations on that theme that are so interesting. And the way Martin sort of pieces together the limitations and the powers of the wargs in this particular context, it's sort of, to me, a really good, subtle example of how accomplished he is.
Yeah.
And interweaving different kinds of influences and elements. So maybe we can circle back to humans and animals.
I would love to do that. I actually have a few questions about that. I want to read this one line from, this is what Mira says. Mira thought so too. Later that night when she and Jojen met Bran in his room to play a three-sided game of tiles, but her brother shook his head. The things I see in green dreams can't be changed. That made his sister angry. Why would the gods send a warning if we can't heed it and change what is to come? I don't know, Jojen said sadly. So a couple assumptions here. I guess Mira's thinking about this theologically.
Yes.
Green dreams are from the gods. And then the second is they are a warning. To me, that kind of passes the smell test. Mm-hmm. Prophecy has a long history in religious tradition. And it doesn't usually exist just on its own. It's not like the universe is trying to tell me something. That's a very modern concept. It's usually attributed to some kind of God, and it's usually used as a warning of some kind. Mm-hmm. Is that your sense of it?
That's a good starting point.
Okay. So question is, in Martin's world, is it right to think of green dreams as visions from the gods?
I don't know if we have another choice in how to interpret it. Okay. And I just in the sense that, Melisandre or the sort of priests and priestesses of the Lord of Light, they're also given ecstatic visions in different ways. Now, she, we learn over time, is pretty poor at interpreting these and very determined to interpret them correctly. And it leads down some sort of tragic paths with her. Mm. But we're not necessarily given to believe that the visions are false. It's the failure is in interpretation. And so I do think that it is one of the sort of underpinning kind of theological ideas in the text that deities in this world can give certain people, choose to give certain people visions of the future that reveal sort of what is to come.
Hmm.
I think that's a fair statement about this world.
Well, just within this chapter, we kind of have a proof of concept, right? Because it's like, I don't know if there's a deity involved, but in a previous chapter, Jojen said, look, you're going to get some news, and the Freys are going to get some news, and their news is going to be worse than yours. but they're going to like their news better. You know, in basic, you know, it's sort of framed as a meal or whatever, but that's what happens. And that's what gets Bran to think that he knows what he's talking about. I should stop listening to Lewin. Lewin doesn't know what he's talking about. Dreams do come true. Now I think I see what Jojen's all about, right?
I think that, yes, I think that's also true. What I think is interesting, and this goes back to your original line from Mira, though, is sort of what are the limits of free will and human choice in affecting outcomes? And Jojen comes down, you know, when he says the dreams come true. There is, you can't change them. And that is true to some extent. But there are still all of these areas around that sort of central belief, or that central sort of metaphysical idea in this work, that I think still are open to interpretation or are open to alteration. And we don't get a discussion of that. And again, this is, so for instance, you know, in the vision of Winterfell being drowned by the sea, and there are certain men that Jojen sees and he can identify, and there are however many there are, three or five that get named. But do we know, you know, in the what's the death toll in the dream versus the death toll in what actually happens? What about, are there actions that people take in light of this dream that mitigate some of the outcomes? Is there space for human action? You know, would Bran and Rickon have actually been killed? Or, you know, if not for the revelation of this vision. So I think there might be more room between the Jojen and the Mira position, but it's hard to tease out what that is, because again, we don't have the theology of the seven or the old gods in this book. We don't know sort of what the canonical beliefs about these things are. So I think we're just kind of trying to piece it together for ourselves in much the same way that the characters are.
Yeah, I feel like Jojen probably, he shouldn't feel as certain as he does that he knows how to interpret these things. And I may, maybe it's sort of like, let's take it at sort of a superficial level. Yes, of course, someone who eventually is named Reek will kill two kids that are sort of named after the fact, Bran and Rickon. He doesn't know enough to be able to nuance the dream in that way.
Right.
And Mel has the same problem. You know, it's like, here's what I saw, and this is what it means. And it's the sort of that second part, this is what it means, that absolutely doesn't warrant that kind of confidence. But he's confident enough that he's taking action, and the action is moving the plot of this book in such a way that, you know, ultimately pushes Bran. I guess what I'm saying is that I think we should trust Jojen. I think that the book is telling us to trust Jojen.
Yes.
And yet it's also telling us to sort of like, the green dreams are indeed true, but then the interpretation of the truth is going to be a problem.
Exactly. There's a limitation to it. And it calls for a certain amount of like, almost humility in terms of being so confident that you understand what they mean. Whereas, and you know, again, Melisandre has self-confidence in spades. And in this respect, Jojen does too. And he's got some evidence that what he sees occurs.
Yeah.
Right. That is not an unfounded belief. But the idea of he understands the full extent of it does sort of drive, you know, drives the action forward, as you say. And I mean, I guess I can't help but think of Oedipus in this.
Oh, interesting.
You know, like the man who has a dream that he'll kill his father and marry his mother and makes every decision in his life to make that, you know, to avoid that fate.
Right.
But
he can't do it.
It's unavoidable. Yeah, you can't do it. Yeah. And all of these decisions based on the certainty of, if I do this, if I do A, then B cannot happen, essentially kind of guarantees that B happened. So, I mean, that to me is the sort of, you know, that's maybe the most sort of canonical, kind of prophetic dream text to me. And I, the whole time I'm reading this chapter and thinking about the visions and then, you know, knowing again as a rereader how it all plays out, you know, it's very frustrating, but I mean that as a compliment. You know, that we can understand or we can foresee to some extent what's coming.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that efforts to change it, or even at this childlike level, you know, ultimately it might mitigate it to some extent, but it can't prevent these things from happening.
Okay, I got one more thing to say about dreams, then I want to talk about wargs. Brandt seems to say that he's got three kinds of dreams. He's got the dreams where he's a wolf, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually slipping into the skin of an animal. Then he's got dreams of a tree calling him, and there's a three-eyed crow in that dream. And then there's the dream of him falling. And I don't know if this works out perfectly, but you could frame it as the wolf dreams are happening now.
Yes.
The tree portends something in the future, and mm-hmm. the falling is something in the past. So I don't know if that was sort of intended to sort of kind of foreshadow some of the timey-wimey elements of the later story, or it could be that I may be foisting a past, present, future paradigm on this because I find that mm-hmm. more interesting. What do you think?
I think that makes sense. I mean, yes, you are, you know, on one level, that's your observation is just it tracks, right? Like this past trauma, the sort of current, what is my wolf doing? And then the future, the sort of calling of what he's supposed to do and who he's supposed to become. And then I think you add in a layer that, you know, from the very beginning, there's this demand that Bran just fly, right? That don't fall, fly. Mm-hmm. And that's the way his opening of his third eye, because of this particular experience he's had, right? That's the language that's being used to describe this process of becoming for him. It's when he stops falling and starts flying. So I think, again, there's a kind of, there's an interesting like elision and the way that works in terms of time, where this event in the past is also in the future will allow him to open up. But I think it gets to that idea of experiencing time, not in the sort of linear manner, but as different times coexisting.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's a good, that's right? a good observation.
And I guess for me too, I will admit, you know, like I am trained sort of with some theology, but also like religious history. And so when I was reading this and thinking about dreams and, you know, thinking about the Jojen, Mira, Bran sort of conversation about knowing what will happen and what does that mean for us as humans and the way we engage in the world. You know, this has been a really vexed question in the history of Christianity forever. And, you know, really since the late Roman world, especially, where you have philosophers who are thinking about, you know, if we believe in an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good God who knows exactly what I will do in a few days, does that leave space for free will? And, you know, the sort of tortuous intellectual answer, and it oscillates over time in the Christian tradition, is that, you know, God knowing what will happen does not mean that the deity elects to cause it to happen. Those are human choices. Knowing the end result, because God exists outside of time and experiences past, present, and future all as a sort of, as a unity, you know, there is the sense that, again, knowing is not causing. And that's, I think, very difficult to sort of wrap our brains around. But it feels a little bit like that's what's happening with Bran's dreams and the way he ultimately will learn to experience time as this, again, this sort of unity as opposed to a linear progress. And so I think we're getting the first inklings of that, as you say, in the three kinds of dreams, because his conscious mind can't process it yet.
Hmm. Well, and to give Jojen a bit of credit, you know, Mira asks him this theological question, like, why would the gods act this way?
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of laments, I don't know. And so there's your humility for you. You know, in other words, he doesn't know why. He just has seen this thing work, and it never fails to work. And so what else do you want from me? So I think that that, you know, that kind of is another way to answer the question. Like, shrug your shoulders. Who can know the mind of a god? I mean, that would be another way to deal with a question like that.
No, that is a good point. And because I would not have initially ascribed, you know, because of Jojen's certainty about the interpretation of dreams, I think of him, you know, humility isn't a word I immediately ascribe. Sure. But you are right that, like, in terms of the why does it happen this way, you know, his response is to sort of to shrug. But now that I'm thinking through this, and I maybe we're not supposed to jump ahead this much, but like thinking about how the conversation of these two dreams in tandem in this chapter, that Winterfell will fall, that something, you know, a catastrophe is coming for Winterfell, and that Bran and Rickon will have their faces taken by this person named Reek. Knowing what happens in the first dream does sort of enable Bran and Rickon to escape the fate that they're maybe, quote unquote, supposed to suffer in the second dream. Hmm. And so even as they can't change those two things from happening, understanding the first in the context of the dream changes the meaning of the second. And so that's another interesting kind of space to play with in terms of why does this knowledge help if you can't change the content, the ostensible subject of the dreams? Well, in this case, you know, it means that the Bran and Rickon he sees in the dream are not actually them. And maybe if not, if they didn't have this conversation or weren't forewarned with these dreams, maybe they actually just would have been killed. I don't know. But it's,
yeah,
it's,
if you wanted to kind of take the more, if you wanted to take the Jojen line on this, you could say, well, no, that happened. That happened exactly the way I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I just, it just wasn't Bran and Rickon.
Right.
It could just be that, yeah, no, that was going to happen, and it happened. I misread a few details, but the details happened. But your point is well taken, because if Jojen is not sitting in that room telling him the dreams, there's no reason to leave Winterfell at all.
That's right.
Now, I could imagine a sort of a parallel universe where, you know, Bran and Rickon do escape, and then they are found, and that does happen to them. I don't know if what that says about Theon, if that's what happens, but you could well imagine a situation where it is Bran and Rickon who end up dying. I don't know. I mean, but he doesn't even have the right reek, you know. So anyway.
I'll tell you what, I have to be honest, that's one more piece of this. I could totally, I don't need Reek in my life. That is not a character that needed to occupy my brain space or words on the page. That is one of those sort of extras that's going around here where I'm like, I'm good.
Yeah, no, good. I'll push back on that a little bit. Like, I usually take that view, but it's a great example of Martin taking a character who's pretty much unlikable, completely unlikable.
Yes.
And then sort of twisting, you know, manipulating the story enough that you actually start to feel sympathy for that person. And he does this with a few other characters too, right? But Theon's kind of the parade example of this, I feel like.
Oh, man. Maybe. I'll go to maybe with you on that. I'll go to maybe. No, I think you are 100% correct about Martin's ability to do that over and over again. Mm-hmm. I would say someone like the Hound is maybe like one of the best examples of that.
Hound, you got Jamie. You know, you kind of you know, you kind of go back and forth with a few of these characters. But I do want to talk about wargs and wolves and skin changers and whatnot.
Absolutely.
What struck you as this phenomenon is described in this chapter?
So it's really, really interesting to me because there is an incredibly long history in Greco-Roman thought, Central Asian cultures, eventually in sort of Norse mythology, up through the Middle Ages, and then of course into the 19th and 20th centuries, about people changing into animals. And I'll preface this by saying I know that's not exactly what's happening here. And among the animals, wolves reappear all of the time, yeah, as the sort of this changing into. And so it's a fascinating sort of historical phenomenon in that sense. And then even you have someone like St. Augustine, who writes in the City of God that some men think they change into wolves, but they do not. Uh-huh. This is an illusory metamorphosis, yeah, right? This doesn't actually happen. It's basically a mental illness. And so this idea of those, the dream state in which we become something other than ourselves, like, is a really fascinating, again, sort of mythological, literary, psychological phenomenon that's been documented for 2,000 years. So I find that amazing.
Right.
But then, you know, Martin, as is his way, is putting a little bit, he's importing something else. The other parallel that came to mind is the idea of the witch's familiar.
Oh, tell me more with this.
So this is an idea, it's largely associated with the English witch trials in the 16th and 17th centuries. But the idea that one of the marks of a witch is that they have an animal who is a physical manifestation of the demonic spirit that has sort of perverted them and taken them away from religious truth. Now, we have mentions of familiars earlier on, but it becomes sort of a canonical part of witch trials in England and Scotland, in the British Isles, we'll say, like in the late 16th and into the 17th century. And so this idea that women are and men are spotted with large toads, unusual dogs, they can be other animals, cats, obviously, but this idea that it's almost, again, like a projection of the witch's magical abilities and a visible reminder of their pact with the devil.
That's so interesting.
So you have the familiar, right? And so
this is
when
called
you think
the
about
witch's familiar.
The familiar, yes. And so it's just really, really interesting to me that, and I don't know if Martin sort of is reading up on his, you know, King James and his sort of demonological treatises. But again, this idea of the animal projection of a magic user's spirit combined with this long tradition of sort of lycanthropy or people transforming into actual animals. It's a fascinating conjunction. And then as we learn more and more about this ability over the course of the books and it becomes the sort of form of mind control in certain cases, it becomes even more expansive and interesting. And I just, once again, this is the book taking all of these diverse influences in and weaving them together into this really compelling kind of character in some sense, just by pulling all these threads together. I really enjoy it. And I will admit, when I was reading, sort of rereading this and thinking about the wargs, it sent me down an extremely deep kind of rabbit hole of medieval lycanthropy and sort of what's a
now,
werewolf
what would the
and,
witches
or werebear.
Do with these animals? Were they influenced by the demon that possesses the animal, or, you know, would they like do the witch's bidding, or like how would this all work?
So that's a good question. It depends. Sometimes you do have the animals sort of accused of performing acts of maleficium, you know, the sort of evil magic as an agent of the witch. In some cases, in art, for instance, you'll see witches sometimes flying to the witches' Sabbaths, these sort of nighttime nocturnal gatherings on animals, some of which are identified as their familiars. That's more of a continental thing. That's very German. There are a lot of woodcuts from the 16th century of this happening. In other cases, though, it is almost as if the familiar is a reminder to the witch of the pact they've made. And so it is almost as if, like, if you are if you're accused of witchcraft and you have a pet that's around you a lot, that is almost like irrefutable evidence of your witchiness. Particularly if you're keeping a pet frog. Don't keep a pet frog in early 17th century England. That's my advice to everybody.
It's really funny.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, again, like, there are mentions of these kinds of things as early as like the 12th century, but it's only in the specific sort of legal culture and the way that precedents and sort of literature preserve memories of trials, where familiars are really an English thing. And England, for the record, is not a particularly intense witch hunting society in the early modern period, relatively speaking. But it has very distinctive, you have these sort of regional subcultures of witchcraft. And so, whereas, you know, werewolves and werewolf beliefs are way more popular in sort of the Baltic regions, is where you see a lot of those sort of percolating. That makes sense. It's sort of a leftover in some ways from sort of, again, pre-Christian paganism in that region and, you know, Norse beliefs. There's a lot of wolves in Norse mythology.
All right, before we get to the wolves, because I love the wolves. At one point, Jojen's called Frog Boy.
Yes.
And I wonder, like, is that a coincidence? Or is this sort of like a nod to this familiar toad situation?
Oh, I don't. That would be, that's funny. I didn't read it that way. Because, I mean, they're always, you know, Mira's got her frog spear. And the idea that the reeds always eat frogs is these sort of marsh dwellers. That's where I saw it. But listen, if we want to attach that sort of, you know, magical element to Jojen, and this is one piece of it, sure, I'm more than happy.
I'll go one more inch out on my limb that's about to crack. Two chapters ago, Jojen asks, or two brand chapters ago, Jojen asks, do you ever dream of a lizard lion? And I just thought that was sort of like a crocodile or whatever. But that's sort of like, that was his first question to Bran before he asked about the wolf thing. And it almost seems like, well, in the Crannogs, there are wargs, but they're sort of the default for the warg is to go into some kind of like river creature.
That makes sense.
So anyway, interesting.
So that really then, this idea of the sort of attachment that you have to particular kinds of animals through experience and affinity. I mean, that makes perfect sense that it would be this sort of distinctive creature. Yeah. And I forget when they talk about this, but also the idea of, you know, you never want to sort of have an affinity with a prey animal. You want a predator.
Oh, okay. That brings us to wolves, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, it would be easier to link up with a dog.
Right. So one
and dogs are fine.
One of the things that Bran thinks when, you know, he gets basically Jojen lays it all out. He's like, you're a warg. Some people call them beastling. Some people call them skin changers. But you're actually slipping into Summer's skin when you're sleeping. It really disturbs Bran. And the reason why it disturbs Bran is that wargs in all of the stories are evil. There's no...
Yes.
Mythology of a warg being a good guy in Bran's mythology. So that kind of reminded me like of the place that wolves are situated in Christian lore. I feel like, and I don't know if it, and I really don't know of any example where this is not true. The wolf is the devil's creature. Like if you think of these medieval bestiaries, the wolf is as evil as the dragon. That is a devil in dog skin, that guy.
No, I mean, I think you're right. The wolf is definitely not a positive animal, generally speaking. The only even vaguely positive story I can think of is St. Francis and the Wolf of Gubbio, I think. Is that the name of the town?
Oh, interesting.
But even in that, the problem is the wolf is a killer and is ravaging this town. But St. Francis, you know, goes out and speaks to it and basically transforms the wolf's behavior. So it becomes a protector instead of a ravager. But that scene is, you know, a miraculous inversion.
Well,
it also proves the
pattern, right? Like if St. Francis can even convert a wolf.
Exactly.
So that's interesting.
And so I think though, you know, the flip side of that is that even in Norse mythology, and this is far afield for me, but I was doing some research on it earlier today, it feels like there is a space for recognition that while wolves tend to have a destructive component, if you can channel that or somehow marry it to human nature, valor, it becomes incredibly powerful. And so this idea of warriors kind of channeling a wolf spirit or even putting on a wolf's pelt and transforming. In the context of battle, it can be a good thing. But once again, that just confirms that wolves are, you know, wolves are killers. And I think even in the realm, you know, obviously the word warg brings to mind Tolkien,
right,
where they're absolutely terrifying creatures. I don't know. I know this is outside of canon for the series. Really, I think Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time is like one of the few literary exceptions or fantasy literary exceptions where wolves are good.
Okay.
But that's neither here nor there.
I want to take back what I said.
Oh.
All right. There's one story, The Werewolves of Ossory. Are you familiar with this?
No, I don't think I am.
This is comes from Irish lore. It's sort of in a travel narrative. So so I'm going to do this from memory. So there's this traveling priest, and he's, you know, he's going from town to town in Ireland, and he's doing the kinds of things priests do for people that don't have a church or a chapel in their village.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's doing last rites. He's performing communion ceremonies, things like that. And he gets shipwrecked, and he, like, gets washed to the shores, and he's freezing cold, and he lights a fire, and a wolf comes up and starts talking with him. And the wolf says, "Hey, don't be afraid. I was transformed into a wolf, and so is my wife, and I would love it if you would come give us Holy Communion, but you got to come back to our cave." And the priest is like, "I'm not doing that." And he's like, "Look, I'll take a Catholic test. Like, give me a theology test. I'll prove that I'm Catholic." And he does. He does, and he passes the test. And so the priest goes back to the cave, and the priest objects some more just to prove that he's really pious because wolves are the devil's creature. And then what ends up happening is, in order to prove that he and his wife were once human, he, like, uses his wolf's claw and unzips, or, you know, like he makes a cut. He cuts the she-wolf's belly and flips over open the skin, and there's a human wife underneath the skin of the wolf. And this proves to the priest that this isn't your normal wolves. These are unfortunate people who were turned into wolves somehow. And he ends up performing last rites because a woman is about to die. And then they ask him to perform Holy Communion, and he objects again, but he ends up doing that as well. And then he tells his superiors about this. And there's this council that is assembled to try to decide whether this priest did the right thing. And the moral of the story at the end of the day was like, if Christ can turn water into wine, why couldn't a man turn into a wolf? Or it was something crazy like that. Anyway, there's an example of two wolves who are pretty decent. They're just good Catholic people who had the unfortunate werewolf curse.
I was going to ask, how did they get turned into wolves?
I have to go reread the story.
Because I believe there are examples in classical literature of people turned into wolves for a period of time.
Like usually 7 years, if they ate the wrong meat or something.
It usually for acts of desecrating graves or sort of eating inappropriate foods. Right. And so who knows, maybe they ate the consecrated host when they weren't supposed to, or swiped one from the previous traveling priest. But that's really interesting.
All right. I was just trying to reread some of the original story here. I don't know if they talk about why they became wolves, but it's a very ancient problem, right? Werewolves are a very ancient problem.
Wolf transformation is an issue throughout time,
and different religious traditions have dealt with them differently. But I mean, even in that story that I just told, sort of the end of it shows the default Catholic position.
Correct.
You just dealt with like a demonic creature. You're not supposed to give that person Holy Communion.
And I think what's interesting, though, is also, again, in the sort of Norse tradition, is that the wolf is very much a symbol of that, like, sort of liminal space between settlement and wilderness.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it has that sort of spirit of wildness in it. And even if it's terrifying or scary or seen as a strong predator, you know, there's also the pack mentality, and there's a sense that they can be loyal and work together and, you know, bring down larger prey. And so the idea of, you know, the wolf as symbol of Winterfell, as symbol of the Starks, and Bran sort of embodying that in a way, even as sort of the weakest member of the pack, so to speak, because of his injury, mm-hmm. and becoming something stronger, you know, that can protect, can contribute, I think is an interesting playing out of the North as this sort of liminal space, right? Between the civilization of the South and the wildness.
Here's why I love that. It's because it's almost like, you know, if you want to press the metaphor, it's like before we had civilization, you know, before we had these castles and whatnot, the only way to survive was sort of pack mentality. So it's almost like the mm-hmm. wolf pack represents a previous era of dog-eat-dog existence.
Yes.
And then, of course, so you've got that anxiety. Like, we could always devolve. You know, we've got this wonderful civilization. We could always devolve into, you know, this is a lot of what zombie stories are about, you know.
Yes.
But, and then, of course, if you take that a little bit further, you could say, well, yeah, in order for him to, like, open his third eye and find his wolf nature, he has to go off the edge of the world. You know, he has to go beyond the wall. Yes. Civilization does not exist north of the wall in this mythology. So it's mm-hmm. almost like he's not just leaving the walls of Winterfell behind. He's leaving the wall of civilization behind.
Right, the world of men. And then if you think then back to Jojen, as somebody else who shares these affinities, uh-huh. you know, they live in this marsh area. They don't build castles. Right. They don't have any of those marks of civilization. They live in an internal wilderness. Yeah. And so perhaps they're the only people. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if there was like some, you know, nomadic desert people in Dorne with a strong, you know, warg tradition either, but it takes those unsettled places.
Yeah, they are the Krannic men are basically the most liminal of all of the houses yes. that we hear about, right?
And yet, like, also the best of the houses, you know, the most loyal, the most true,
right.
in some ways. Yeah. So
the least corrupted by the absolutely. Trappings of civilization.
I'm really into the Reeds. I can't lie. Anytime they show up, like I do like their presence and the way they move.
And you know what? I mean, I think that's one of the main reasons people want to see the next book. It's like, we want to see Howland Reed. You know, that's sort of like one of the main things that we feel like we've missed.
Yeah. And again, this is back to sort of in praise of Martin and making, in very sneaky ways, making you care deeply mm-hmm. about things that either seem unlikable or unimportant. And, you know, if you fail to notice it the first time, thankfully there's Reddit and the second or third reread, where these things and like the way that it's built yeah. up from something's introduction all the way through its sort of culmination, there's always this process of layering. And, you know, kind of seeing the pieces get slowly put together is a lot of fun. If only we had the next book.
Notable introductions in this chapter. We hear about Ashmark, that it was formerly held by House Marbrand. Mm-hmm. We hear about several Frey uncles for the first time. But who cares?
Yes.
Like, for all of the things, all the reasons we love the Reeds, the phrase are like, who cares? Who cares? we meet Reek in the flesh for the first time, the original Reek. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Benfred Tallheart. Departures, goodbye, Severin Frey. We barely knew you.
We barely knew you, yeah. I do love where the Frey boys are just like...
Immediately they go to, well, all right, how does this change the line of succession? It's not even, they don't even take a beat to pretend like they're mourning the loss of their uncle. All right, differences with the show. No prophecy about Bran and Rickon being flayed or killed. There's none of this ale belly business. And
it's Bran's
dream. There's no, I don't think that we have a mention of an original reek in the show, or at least he doesn't come to Winterfell for sure. But yeah, and you're right. Like the ocean coming to Winterfell, that is Bran, right? That's not Jojen.
It is. It is. And he's talking about it with Asha as he's mounting his horse in the courtyard. And I mean, I'm not surprised by that move, but at the same time, the whole conversation, which has been at the center of our conversation, isn't there. And yeah, this idea of really being not just confused by what a dream might be, but like shaken by what the truth of dreams means for us and what it means about our place in the world. So I that was, I think, why I enjoyed this chapter more than I thought I would returning to it, because it's a much weightier sort of space to explore again, kind of like the realities of this world as constructed by Martin.
That there were some people, not me, but there were some people who weren't happy with the whole hold the door thing with Hodor, because the time stuff wasn't well established well enough earlier in the story. In the books, of course, we're having this conversation pretty early in this.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah.
I noted that when Bran asks Asha, "Do you know how to get beyond the wall?" She says, "Well, it's easy. You look for the ice dragon and chase the blue eye of the rider." Yeah, the blue star and the eye of the rider. Which to me sounds like free folk have a constellation that they think of as an ice dragon.
With a blue-eyed rider.
With a blue-eyed rider. And we're talking about, you know, portents of the future and religion and whatnot. You know, one of the most ancient way to tell stories about the gods was to interpret the stars, right?
That's right.
Now, does this, of course, I mean, how can I not think that this portends
the fall of the wall?
The fall of the wall, the ice dragon with the...
Oh my gosh.
The White Walker with the blue eyes riding on the back of the... I mean, that... I completely forgot about that detail.
Yeah. No, I... And I will admit, it did not even... I did not even start to process that until you just mentioned it. And I was like, oh yes, all those details do match up.
So it's one of these things where it's almost like... Exactly. I mean, George can drop these details and decide to do nothing with them, right?
Correct.
At least... The showrunners were inspired by this, I think. This can't be totally meaningless. That's my feeling.
I don't think so. And this feels more like the idea of one of the dragons being taken and sort of converted into the White Walker dragon. That had to be part of the blueprint.
Or
it's too. I don't know.
Here's another theory to throw at you. I think that there's like a fan theory that there's like this mythology that there's a dragon that's in the wall. Like there's actually a dragon in the ice that makes up the wall.
Okay.
And eventually that dragon will sort of be called forth by a great horn or something. And that's how the wall falls or something. But either way, we kind of have an ice dragon. And so you can kind of see the showrunners getting to the ice dragon in a different way, and also a way that kind of levels the playing field.
It does. And it just makes for, like, it's visually spectacular and narratively efficient answer to one of the really big questions, which is how is the army of the dead going to get past the wall? Right. I mean, because like that is you have to be thinking about that because they don't like water, you know, like there are limitations. And so what's it going to be? And they solve that problem. And so that's why I think the plans for the ice dragon were probably laid early, because, I mean, it's a staggering, shocking moment.
Yeah.
That resolves some big questions immediately in a delightful way. So I'm going to choose to believe that this is this foreshadowing, dare we say, prophecy of the Ice Dragon.
Yeah.
And the fall of the wall is the groundwork's being laid here. It's prophecies within dreams. You know, they're all right here in this chapter.
Yeah, I mean, for a character that maybe isn't a favorite in this book, this chapter did a lot of heavy lifting.
It does. And, you know, I'm going to feel guilty about saying that I don't like Bran at the very beginning. But I do think that this chapter does work. And I found it, again, just really interesting in the way it probes some of the sort of belief systems or the ideas about the way this world works, and something like fortune or fate or providence or astrology, whatever you want it to be, the way it's sort of, if not predetermining, at least giving some hints of how things might unfold, and the need for that for people. And then the challenge that puts on some people, you know, if the portents can't be changed, what are we even doing?
In order to make this an interesting problem, you have to introduce limitations to interpretation.
Yes.
I mean, in addition to all of the sort of philosophical stuff we were talking about, just in terms of storytelling, you can't have one character that knows exactly what's going to happen in the future, or else it ruins the story, right?
Except we do ultimately end up there.
Well, if you introduce, I guess in the hands of a lesser writer, that'd be a problem.
There are no knights at Greywater. So when Mira used the net to trap Summer, Bran has never seen someone fight with a net before. How did you learn this from your master at arms? And she says, there's no knights at Greywater. So then this brings back to the thing about that we discussed briefly earlier with Howland Reed. So Howland Reed is not a knight. And did Arthur Dayne basically get trapped in a net and couldn't swing down?
I was thinking the same thing. I mean, technically, you know, Ned's not a knight, right? The North does not knight people in the way that Southern culture knights people. But there's been so much sort of hybridity between the cultures that basically Ned has, you know, he's functioning as a knight, basically, right?
What's your lord, though? It's a little bit different.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. Although, even Ned's retainers, like Rory, fights in the tournament, although he's not technically a knight. You know, it's like these warriors up north do a lot of the things that knights do, and they, you know, they ride horses and they wear armor and whatnot. They take honor seriously, and they've got a code. But the culture at Greywater is so isolationist that there has not been, you know, you don't get the sense that someone like Howland Reed would fight in a tournament.
Yeah.
And it could be that Mira is actually quite powerful because, you know, you've never seen someone fight with a net before. How would a knight know how to fight against someone fighting with a net?
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I mean, I can't imagine. fighting with a net, and I can't imagine it being all that effective, but it does give you the sense that Mira can actually take down a dire wolf if she wants to.
Yeah,
and that kind of gives us a little bit of hope for her ability to protect Bran up north.